Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarah for the Herald Tribune Fourth Letter, Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by John Kennedy, Gatehouse Florida's state capitol correspondent. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
Well, Hurricane Barry didn't do much damage last weekend, but Hurricane Donald sent shockwaves through the country again with another comment that many saw as racist. We'll talk about the Florida reaction to Trump's tweet telling four congresswomen of color to leave the country. We'll also talk about a legal challenge to Florida's new sanctuary city ban and whether Florida will be a major battleground when it comes to congressional races next year. But first, podcast listeners know what that music means. It's time to pick a number. John, what's your number today?
Zach, I've been going low lately and even using decimal places, but this week I'm coming in with a robust number, 260,000.
260,000, all right. Well, John, when you go high, I go low. My number today is 26. Write those numbers down, folks, and we'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, it's hard to keep track of the outrage cycles generated by our president sometimes, many of which stem from the racial implications of his remarks. The latest kicked off Sunday when Trump targeted a group of Democratic congresswomen on Twitter. Trump said the women, quote, originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe and should, quote, go back to those countries. Now, all of these women are non-white, leading many to conclude that Trump was employing a racist trope in telling people of color to leave the country and go back where they came from, something that many found even more galling because these women are all American citizens and three of the four were born in America. The firestorm that proceeded led to Democrats and four Republicans in the House voting to officially condemn Trump's remarks as racist. But most Republicans, including the 14 GOP House members and two GOP U.S. senators from Florida, either declined to criticize the president or offered some fairly mild rebukes. I reached out to the offices of Vern Buchanan and Greg Stuve, two Republican congressmen who live in Sarasota County, and neither said Trump's comments were racist. Instead, they criticized the Democratic reaction to Trump's tweets. Senator Rick Scott went further and explicitly said Trump's comments were not racist. He then went after Democrats, saying, quote, they've become the anti-Semitic party now, and so that's wrong. A number of Florida Democrats said that Scott's comments were offensive, including Florida Congressman Ted Deutch, who said the comments were not only ridiculous, they are also offensive to all of us, Democrats and Republicans, who work hard together to advance Jewish values and the U.S.-Israel relationship. So you have a firestorm within a firestorm there. The only GOP lawmaker from Florida to offer any real criticism of Trump's comments was Senator Marco Rubio. The son of Cuban immigrants wouldn't call Trump's tweets racist, but he did say, quote, I think identity politics is a poison. It's toxic. I think that's true when members of Congress practice it, but the presidency and the words of a president carry even greater weight in terms of the impact on society. The president shouldn't have written that. I think it damages him, but it damages the country, and none of us should be participating in identity politics. Jeb Bush, the former presidential candidate and Republican governor of Florida, tweeted that Trump is hurting his cause with such tweets, and quote, the ugliness should stop. So you have Bush calling the comments ugly and Rubio calling them poison that, quote, damages the country. But most Republicans seemed okay with the president using white identity politics to rally his base. Rubio even seemed to back off of his comments a bit after he gave that first quote to the Miami Herald saying that Trump damaged the country. He posted a video on Twitter criticizing the Democratic reaction to Trump's tweets and comparing it to how they responded when one of the congresswomen that Trump criticized made what many perceived to be an anti-Semitic comment about Jewish people not being loyal to America. Here's a clip of Rubio.
I don't think two wrongs make a right, but I recall 3-4 months ago when there was clearly statements made by a member of Congress that American Jews could not truly be loyal to the United States. The Democrats in the House didn't want to vote on a bill that condemned that statement or condemned anti-Semitism by name. And so now all of a sudden they're willing, however, to move forward on one that labels the president a racist. I think here's a better approach. Why don't we all just agree that where you come from, how your last name is pronounced, the color of your skin, your ethnicity is irrelevant to whether or not you're an American. Anyone can be an American. And it has nothing to do with your ethnicity, your race, your gender. And the second thing is we should all of us be more careful in constantly relying on ethnic or gender or racial-based grievances and attacking our opponents. I think their over-reliance on this sort of identity politics is a poison. It's a toxic poison that is hurting our country, and I hope we'll all walk away from it. That would be a better resolution than the one they're voting on today.
John Kennedy, I guess it's not surprising that Republicans are hesitant to call Trump a racist or even criticize him at all at this point. He's proven hugely popular with the GOP base, and rank-and-file lawmakers are probably wary of crossing him. But it did seem like this was a particularly explosive comment. What are your thoughts on the GOP reaction?
Well, it sure was. It seems to go to the core of who we are as Americans. You know, that idea, if you come here, legally, and you make it, then you belong. You know, I think in a state like Florida, with a 20% foreign-born population, that idea seems to resonate even louder, I think. But, you know, not only that, Trump's attack was basically defended in an almost party line vote in the U.S. House. You had only four Republicans joining in with party line Democrats issuing a rebuke to the president for his comments. That was the first such common condemnation of a chief executive formally passed by Congress in almost 100 years. But then you had the Palm Beach County Republican Party taking Trump's steps, even further by disinviting former Trump spokesman Anthony Scaramucci from a fundraising event, only because he was critical of his former boss tweets as, racist. In Congress, no Florida Republicans criticized Trump, as you pointed out. Florida Senator Rick Scott joined in the Trumpian dialogue by calling Democrats the anti-Semitic party. That was something of a random shot that drew criticism from Democratic Agricultural Commissioner Nikki Fried. She's the only statewide elected Democrat, and she also happens to be Jewish. In a tweet, Fried called Scott's remarks, quote, insulting, false, and dangerous. So it seems like Trump's, invective is sort of infective as well. You know, he's getting it, getting guys like Rick Scott to take swipes in using that same kind of language. But generally, if anyone thought that the Republican Party isn't the party of Trump, you know, inseparable in policy and now maybe even in style, well, this episode has certainly erased that doubt.
Yeah, and you brought up the reaction to Rick Scott's comments saying that the Democrats are anti-Semitic. It kind of, we've talked about this in the past, that Republicans have really tried to cater to Jewish voters. They've really tried to, show strong support for Israel. And it seems like this is a way that they're trying to change the subject. You know, you're calling Trump racist. Well, you guys haven't been as supportive of Israel as you could be, but it was a pretty aggressive statement to call all Democrats anti-Semitic. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think this is all part of an effort by Republicans to just kind of woo Jewish voters to their side. We saw it a little over a month ago with Governor Ron DeSantis on a big trade mission to Israel, his first foreign trip as governor. It is something that former Governor Scott has also done and also has tried to play that card as well, trying to get, and it comes down from the White House as well, where there's this overall theme that this administration has been much more friendly toward the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu, and it's one where they're hoping that will translate into bringing some voters away from the Democratic Party, where the Jewish vote has typically gone, over to the Republican side, and these kind of toss up states like Florida, where just a few thousand votes either way could make a difference in carrying the electoral votes next year.
Definitely. Well, Trump doubled down on his remarks last night at a rally in North Carolina. He was really going after Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minneapolis, one of the four that he originally targeted in his tweets. She's a refugee from Somalia, American citizen. And she went after Trump started talking about her, the crowd started chanting, send her back," which many people found pretty galling. What do you think, John? I mean, it seems like Trump is really trying to position himself against these very liberal congresswomen, women of color, and you know, kind of campaign against them, at least early on in this campaign. Do you think that that works for him? Do you think that this tactic is going to get his base rallied up?
I think it does. I think it's something that, you know, he has managed to make these four members of the so-called squad, the symbol of the Democratic Party nationally. This is not the party of Nancy Pelosi, who has had her own problems, in the view of Trump. This is the party of Ilhan Omar and AOC. And, you know, it's just something that he can inflame his base by identifying the Democratic Party with that. And I think for a lot of middle of the road voters, these socialist themes that Pelosi, as much more of a mainstream Democrat, has been trying to somewhat distance the party from in an effort to try to appeal to more, you know, a larger cross-section of voters, it's making her job that much harder. She had some success this week by kind of fending off this push for impeachment, which she has been, very wary of treading into, because it seemed as something that, while it may satisfy some parts of the Democratic Party, it may also just further empower the Republican base and rally support behind Trump. So Trump, you know, in its own weird way, this is a sort of a master political stroke, I guess, by Trump to try to, redirect attention in the Democratic Party on these four outliers that, you know, maybe are not reflective of the overall themes of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I read that, especially some moderate Democrats are sort of nervous about getting into this fight with Trump and really, pitting this as him against, these liberal congresswomen, because that's not how they want the party to be perceived. And there's a number of folks like that in Florida, you know, moderates like Stephanie Murphy and others who probably don't want to be having this fight as much. Much of Trump's incendiary rhetoric around race has stemmed from the issue of immigration, which has been his focal point from the very beginning of his campaign. Republicans in Florida have seized on the issue as well. Earlier this year, they passed legislation banning so-called sanctuary policies that prohibit local governments from fully cooperating with federal immigration authorities. The bill was highly contentious, with Democrats and immigrant rights activists saying it would tear apart immigrant families. Now the legislation is being challenged in court by the city of South Miami and various advocacy groups. John, you wrote about this court challenge. What's the argument critics of this law are making as they seek to have it nullified?
Yeah, this lawsuit was filed in federal court in Miami, and it's looking to block the law, which took effect on July 1st. The lawsuit claims that this new so-called sanctuary cities ban, that it violates equal protection guarantees in the federal constitution, and that it also conflicts with federal law. The law basically requires local police agencies to assist federal officials in enforcing the nation's immigration laws. It also prohibits governments from refusing to help the Immigration and Custom Enforcement, ICE, agency when it comes to their policies or their actions. Now, Governor DeSantis, he signed the legislation. He called it a public safety bill. And, we've talked a lot about this legislation in earlier episodes of Inside Florida Politics. It really emerged as one of the most contentious bills of the 2019 legislature, and it regularly drew representatives of these immigrant groups, many of them now plaintiffs in this lawsuit. They crowded committee hearings. They also had some people that, mostly Central American laborers and their families who are working in the agriculture and service industries in Florida. They too were at these committees testifying about how they opposed the bill. Now, the lawsuit was filed right as President Trump brought immigration back into the forefront with you know, this duel with the four Democratic members of Congress. But for Republicans, you know, who control state government in Florida, this ban on sanctuary cities plays right into their base of voters who, again, you know, pumped up by Trump. They are eager to see the state take a swipe at immigration. It's a law that you're going to hear Republican campaigners, you know, talk about next year, leading up to the elections. You know, really, either way, if it stays on the books or somehow it gets tossed by a federal court, you know, it is served its political purpose. It seems like right now, organizations involved in the lawsuit they condemn it as unnecessary. They say it's divisive. They said that local law enforcement should not have to do the job of the federal ICE agency. And, you know, sanctuary cities don't even exist in Florida. That's something that Republican Attorney General Ashley Moody declared this week in a report. But, you know, it's still something that will basically require that local law enforcement now comply with any kind of detainer requests from ICE, and that they would have to hold immigrants that are living illegally in the U.S. if they are arrested for other crimes. And as a part of this lawsuit, it's called, you know, a demand that wrongly forces local governments to assume a role that really belongs to the federal government. And that seems to be at the heart of this constitutional challenge now going to be played out in Miami court.
Well, we've talked about how this is kind of a summer tradition in Florida. You have the spring legislative session. The legislature passes a bunch of laws, and then you know, various groups end up challenging them. We saw that with medical marijuana. We saw that this year with Amendment 4, the Felon Voting Rights Initiative, and now we're seeing it with the sanctuary city ban. It will be interesting to see how this plays out in court, because I'm pretty sure Florida is not the only state that has, you know, sanctuary city bans in place. And I haven't heard of others being overturned in federal court, but I'm not deeply familiar with the legal precedents on this. So we'll have to watch and see what kind of argument they're able to put forward. And, you know, either way, I would assume this will be campaign rallying cry going forward, and definitely something that we'll be hearing a lot about during the 2020 election. All right, well, I want to switch gears here a little bit. Much of the political discussion this week has focused on Trump and the reaction to his latest tweet storm. There's going to be an intense focus on Trump and his Democratic opponent as we head into the 2020 election season. But the second biggest political story of 2020 is the battle for control of Congress. Democrats are trying to hold on to the House and win control of the Senate. They can't really do much to enact their agenda unless they do. And Florida could be another key battleground when it comes to control of the House, especially. Last year, Democrats flipped two GOP-held congressional seats in Florida on their way to winning 40 seats, the most since the Watergate era. But they could have a tougher time trying to flip seats in Florida in 2020. The low-hanging fruit really has already been picked. It's not yet clear what Florida congressional districts will be the big battlegrounds this year, but the time is fast approaching for those races to start taking shape. Over the next few months, we'll see what kind of success the parties have in recruiting strong candidates. There was an intriguing bit of news over in this part of the state in recent days. Somebody registered the internet domain name margaretgoodforcongress.com. Now, Margaret Good is a Democrat from Sarasota who won a nationally watched state House race last year. She flipped a GOP-held seat that Trump carried in 2016, and her special election victory really foreshadowed the blue wave that swept over the country in 2018. With the Margaret Good for Congress domain name being registered, there's speculation that she might challenge Vern Buchanan, a Republican congressman who lives in Sarasota County. And Democrats have been trying to knock off Buchanan for years, but he's proven very resilient. Regardless, it seems like national Democrats may be making a strong effort to recruit Good and put that seat in play. And personally, I thought they might take a pass on trying to knock off Buchanan this year because they had a really well-funded candidate last year who fell short. This district was not part of the blue wave, but I think it kind of shows that there's not many other GOP-held seats for them to focus on in Florida right now. Brian Mast over in Palm Beach Brian Mast over in the Palm Beach area is likely to be targeted, along with Ross Spano in the Tampa area. But the spectrum of flippable seats in Florida has narrowed after Democrats won those two Republican seats last year. So we'll have to wait and see how these races develop. But the news that National Democrats are recruiting Margaret Good just kind of underscores the fact that this is crunch time, and both parties are trying to lock down top-notch recruits and start building up their campaign apparatuses as they fight over not just the presidency, but control of Congress in 2020. John, what are your thoughts on whether Florida will be a big congressional battleground this year?
Well, you know, as you pointed out, it's kind of hard to see where Democrats hope to make gains. The fact that the state's 27-member congressional delegation is now divided 14 Republicans, 13 Democrats. That seems to be quite, you know, reflective of national toss-up state Florida. You can see where a state house member like Margaret Good might see some frustration and might be lured to the congressional campaign. You know, she's in a state house where, you know, Republicans are outnumbered Democrats. It's 73-47 with the Republicans in control. So there's no chance in Margaret Good's lifetime that the Democrats are going to come back to any semblance of power in the House. But they're when it comes to running for Congress and a U.S. House that is in Democratic hands, that's got to be more appealing for a rising politician. There's always the possibility that some kind of scandal or retirement opens a seat. The retirement of longtime Republican Representative Ileana Ross Layton, and that led to the election of Democrat Donna Shalala back in 2018, right, winning that South Miami district.
And you had Dennis Ross over in the Hillsborough area that him retiring turned that into a big battleground in 2018 that Republicans were able to hold on to. But that Ross Spano won that seat and by 6 points, and has since had a lot of controversy surrounding his campaign contributions. I think Democrats view him as vulnerable. So yeah, I mean, retirements can really shake this up substantially.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, Republican incumbents who could be looked at as vulnerable next year, they seem to be in districts that are decidedly Republican leaning. So that doesn't seem to be too many seat switches likely. And Democrats may want to concentrate their spending in Florida on the money and oxygen sucking presidential race that's coming up.
Yeah. You know, as you pointed out, Florida now has 14 Republicans and 13 Democrats. So it's pretty evenly split, which is really what the state is. I mean, you saw our last election cycle, you know, the governor won by less than half a percentage point. Rick Scott won by like a tenth of a percentage point. You know, Florida is just a very closely partisan divide. I mean, the room for error here is very small. So 14 to 13, you kind of, that looks like the parties are kind of in balance here. And so you're really fighting over, you know, maybe two or three seats at the most. I think Democrats are going to be on defensive, mostly trying to protect those two seats that they won in 2018. You know, they also have some kind of more swing seats that they've held a little bit longer, and Stephanie Murphy and Charlie Crist. It seems like Republicans might be a little bit on the offense here if they can recruit some candidates to try and go after some of these South Florida seats. But you always want to be on offense a little bit and keep the other side on their toes. So it'll be interesting to see if they do recruit a strong candidate like Margaret Good to take on Vern Buchanan, or somebody to take on Ross Spano or Brian Mast. At this point, doesn't look like a lot of blockbuster congressional races in Florida, but that can change quickly depending on what kind of success they're able to have in recruiting. And I think we will see that over the next few months here. I don't think, if they don't have somebody good, especially by the end of the year, it's really hard to raise the money that you need and build the campaign apparatus to run a really strong campaign. All right, well, we're going to move on to our pick a number segment. I'll go first. My number this week was 26. 26 is the number of Congress members from Florida who voted against a resolution put forward in the U.S. House yesterday to have an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. So 26 out of the 27 members of Congress from Florida voted against the effort to start impeachment, which just shows that, you know, despite the latest controversy over Trump's tweets, despite the Mueller report, this impeachment issue is still, you know, people are very nervous about this. A lot of Democrats do think that Trump has done impeachable things. But Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, is trying to keep this, keep a lid on this for now. I think she doesn't think this is politically advantageous for Democrats. And at least here in Florida and the majority of Democrats in Congress have decided that, that this is not the time to start an impeachment inquiry into the president. So we'll see how this plays out. I think his latest comments did sort of inflame the issue a little bit. I think that's why this impeachment resolution was introduced. But there still seems unlikely at this point that they're going to start an impeachment inquiry into the president. But you never know what could happen. All right, John. Well, you had 260,000.
Yeah, Zach, my 260,000. That's the number of childless adult Floridians expected to enroll in Medicaid if voters next year agree to expand eligibility to what's considered 138% of poverty. That's about $12,000 a year for an individual. Now, these new numbers come from the state economists who recently met to basically evaluate the new Medicaid expansion proposed constitutional amendment that has collected more than 10% of the needed petition signatures to get on the ballot in November 2020. We've talked about the flurry of citizens initiatives underway, and this one is ready for review by the Florida Supreme Court. Getting some of these estimates in line now, that's all part of the pre-court review. Like most of these ideas in play, these proposals are addressing things that the Republican legislature has failed to do. The last time Medicaid expansion was in play was 2015, when Republicans in the Senate pushed it, but then Governor Rick Scott and the House, they managed to kill the idea, and Florida remains one of 17 states that haven't joined in the expansion, which is, of course, allowed under the Affordable Care Act. Notably, that while getting more health care to 250,000 Floridians sounds significant, that estimate is way down from the numbers that had been promoted back in 2015. Back then, about really close to 900,000 were expected to enroll. Now, in another twist, while 250,000 are expected to enroll this time, as many as 600,000 might qualify, but because of various reasons, not the least of which are Trump administration clampdowns on marketing Obamacare to eligible participants, that the smaller number of Floridians are likely to actually seek out coverage. But, you know, other factors that are reducing the enrollment include, you know, a better economy, which has helped increase some incomes and are keeping more people from falling into the lower income ranks, and Congress repealing the tax penalty for failing to enroll in health coverage. That also has cut some of the momentum behind people enrolling under Obamacare. And so that's, you know, also sapping some of those Florida numbers from back in 2015. But if it does get to the ballot next year, it'll still be a big deal and potentially, you know, a real vote driver, maybe for people on both sides of the Obamacare divide.
Yeah, that's a really interesting number, because I remember when all these debates over expanding Medicaid in Florida, they threw out numbers that were like 800,000 to 1 million people would get coverage if Florida expanded Medicaid. And now, you know, this estimate is saying 260,000. But I guess the difference is, you know, it was like 800,000 to 1 million people would qualify. But they're basically saying this is the number of people who would actually sign up. We think.
Actually enroll in the end. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, really interesting number. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. This will be our last show of July. We're taking 2 weeks off, and we'll be back with weekly episodes on August 8th. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy, Joseph Cordano, and Adam Fish. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.